This is The Takeaway for Friday, February 23rd, 2018.
Dear every elected official, nowhere in my contract does it state that if the need arises, I have to shield students from gunfire with my own body. If it did, I wouldn't have signed it. I love my job. I love my students. I am also a mother with two amazing daughters. I'm a wife of a wonderful man, and I have a dog that I adore. I don't want to die defending other people's children. I want to teach kindness and responsibility and art history. That's what I'm supposed to do each day. Blocking bullets? I am not supposed to do that. I imagine that if someone was trying to kill my students, that I would try to save them with all of my being. I probably would jump on top of a child to save her life. And yes, I might be one of those heroic teachers that the media writes tributes to after their death. But I am furious that I would have to make this sacrifice. I am incensed that my own children would lose their mother because I chose to be a teacher. I chose to be a teacher knowing that on most days, I would not be able to use the bathroom until 4 o'clock. I chose teaching knowing that I would be grading papers all weekend and working far beyond the hours of my contract. I chose to teach even though it meant that I would miss every awards assembly and field trip that my daughters asked me to attend. I even signed up to sit in a counselor's office with a teenager on my lap, holding her as she sobbed through an anxiety attack. I signed up to ask a child if they were considering committing suicide and then relaying this terrifying information to a parent. It seems like a lot to agree to, but truly, I knew what I was getting into. I did not sign up to be ripped apart by a spray of bullets that came from a semi-automatic rifle. At the end of my teaching contract, it says that I will perform other duties to be assigned. I do not interpret these words as bleeding to death on the floor of my classroom. The anger that courses through my body after a school shooting in this country is accompanied by pure panic. I'm terrified of my own children dying in school, first and foremost. But I'm also terrified that the responsibility that sits on my shoulders as a teacher is far greater than I can rationally accept. On back to school night, I look out at the gazes of the parents in front of me as we silently make a pact. I'm giving you the most precious part of me with the knowledge that you will shield my child's body with your own when the need arises. They say this with their eyes, and I agree to this responsibility and make a silent, unbreakable oath before them. As I'm telling them about the 20,000 years of global art history that I will be teaching their child, I am also agreeing to die. When I am in the parent's place at my daughter's school, I'm asking the same of her teacher. This teacher may end up being the only thing blocking a bullet aimed for my daughter's head. I'm furious. How dare you force me to choose between my own children and those that I teach? How dare you allow powerful adults who love guns to be more important than a generation of children growing up in fear? I don't want to spend mornings memorizing my children's clothing so that I can identify them later. I don't want to spend professional development hours learning how to save a few more lives by setting up barricades. Sometimes, when a kid is driving me crazy in class, I think to myself, would I die for you? Would I lose everything to save you from harm? And I have my moments when I shake my head no. Instead of making dead teachers into saints, make them safer when they are alive. Make it possible for schools to have smaller class sizes so that we can get to know our students and look out for the ones who need help. Hire more counselors and school nurses and social workers and psychologists so that many people are caring for each child. Help us prevent this. Take away guns from people who will murder us. Stop taking money from the NRA and proving how soulless you are. Keep us safe so I can do my job. How dare you put me into constant danger so that you can be reelected? How dare you make me choose between saving children or making my own children motherless? How dare you make me into a hero when I just want to teach? Signed, Rebecca Field, art and art history teacher, Richmond, Virginia.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick. Our thanks to Rebecca Field for sharing her perspective to start our show, a conversation we've been having all week.
I think we need hardened sights. We need to let people know, you come into our schools, you're going to be dead, and it's going to be fast.
How do we keep schools safe? The nation is asking that question after the shooting at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School. Students are demanding to know directly from the adults who are supposed to protect them, from parents to police to politicians. Yesterday, we talked about guns and whether gun control measures could actually help protect schools and other places where innocent people gather. But how to fortify a school itself? President Trump has one answer.
I think a concealed permit for having teachers and letting people know that there are people in the building with gun. You won't have, in my opinion, you won't have these shootings because these people are cowards. They're not going to walk into a school if 20% of the teachers have guns. It may be 10% or maybe 40%.
Well, we want to begin today with a look at what we know about what works when schools have to protect themselves, what keeps students safe, and what can actually hurt them even more. Here to help is Rebecca Klein, education reporter at HuffPost and a former producer. Rebecca, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Well, let's start with some news from yesterday from Broward County. The armed sheriff's deputy assigned to protect Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School didn't enter the school during the assault, instead waited outside. This, Rebecca, appears to be a glaring failure in at least one line of defense.
Absolutely. I mean, this is the main reason that schools employ police officers, is to prevent against attacks like this. So it just really shows you can try and do everything and these things still might happen.
Well, let's talk about school resource officers. That's the euphemism often given to a cop who's assigned to a school. In the 2015-2016 school year, about three quarters of schools with 1,000 or more students had a police officer on duty at least most of the time. This is a fairly widespread practice. Has it been shown to be effective in preventing violence or making students safer?
So the jury is out on whether or not it prevents or stops school shootings. There isn't any research proving that it does so. The research shows that there are a few proven benefits. Schools that have employed school resource officers or cops are more likely to have emergency crisis plans in place. They're more likely to have someone regularly patrolling the building. But there's also a lot of ways, an abundance of evidence showing that in some ways cops might make school less safe for some students, particularly vulnerable students. Schools with cops are more likely to arrest students for low-level minor misbehavior, like disorderly conduct, like vandalism, things that maybe a principal or a teacher used to deal with, kids are now getting arrest records for. So the cost-benefit analysis is really questionable so far.
We're getting lots of suggestions from listeners. People have really responded to this, Rebecca. Here's one teacher from New York.
I am an eighth grade teacher on Long Island, and I would like to see steel screens on all of our windows so we can still have fresh air but be safe. And also, I believe that all meetings should take place outside of a school building. Nobody but students and teachers should be allowed in the building during the day.
Screens on windows, meetings outside of buildings, strict access, all suggests a very closed environment in the school. So what about what that would do to the culture of a school, but also, of course, safety?
One of the things that has been proven to deter school crime is to have a positive school climate where students feel safe and welcome, where parents are involved, and where it feels like a staple of the community that everyone is supporting them. And I think there is a lot to say for the fact that if you are closing your school off from the community, whether or not students can feel safe there or whether or not it will feel like an isolated prison-like environment that they're not getting support they need from outside sources.
Well, let's hear from another teacher.
My name is Ken Ebert, a teacher from Albany, New York. We live in a dangerous world, and we need to make our students aware of that and our teachers aware of that. Active shooter drills are important, but I'm not so sure that anything can really keep us safe other than vigilance.
Students at Stoneman Douglas had active shooter drills. How long have those been on the American scene, and what have they accomplished?
So American schools have long had types of drills. It's only in the past few decades that it's switched to active shooter drills. Active shooter drills won't prevent a shooter from coming in, but experts say that they tend to be effective in lowering the amount of carnage that takes place. It is a measure that experts certainly say need to be folded into any school's emergency crisis plan.
Well, Rebecca, one of the most high-profile and controversial policies on offer is arming teachers. President Trump is for it.
So let's say you had 20% of your teaching force, because that's pretty much the number. And you said it. An attack has lasted, on average, about 3 minutes. It takes 5 to 8 minutes for responders, for the police to come in. So the attack is over. If you had a teacher who was adept at firearms, they could very well end the attack very quickly.
And Rebecca, the president has also suggested that teachers could earn bonuses, more money for carrying concealed weapons in schools. Has this been tried anywhere? What do we know about whether this can really help?
So there are a few instances of districts scattered throughout the country. I can think of one off the top of my head in Texas where teachers are armed. And additionally, in some states, concealed carry states, there are teachers who carry weapons while at school. To my knowledge, there hasn't been any evidence of this ever having stopped an armed intruder. There are a few scattered instances of teachers accidentally shooting themselves when they're carrying a gun, or one instance in Pennsylvania a few years ago where a teacher left their gun in the bathroom, so a group of elementary school students found it. Luckily, no one was hurt. So this has happened. There are a lot of risks, clearly, and no indication that this would be an effective way of deterring school shootings.
Rebecca, can we talk about the downside risk of hardening schools across America? We talked about the difference between school violence and mass shooter events, which are rare. The impulse to protect a school, spend a lot of money and put up a lot of infrastructure to protect against a mass shooting is definitely understandable. Seems to me there might be a risk in thinking that this is something that has to be done in every school across America.
I think it's important to note that schools nowadays are pretty much more safe than they've ever been. The decline in school crime has mirrored the decline in crime nationally. So advocates talk a lot about the school-to-prison pipeline, that when you make schools feel like hardened institutions, that it will help push them out of school and into the criminal justice system. There's this thing called school push-out, that if you harden schools, there'll be more suspensions, more expulsions. If you treat students like criminals and make them feel like criminals, then they will follow suit.
Still, it is very, very hard to turn around and tell a parent, no, you have a statistical fallacy in your head. You don't really need to harden your school. That's a hard thing to try to tell somebody who's worried about the safety of their child.
These reactions are totally understandable. When something like as tragic as what happened, you want to feel like you're fixing it. You want to feel like you're taking action. And it certainly makes sense as a short-term solution, but experts really recommend thinking about this long-term.
Rebecca Klein, education reporter at HuffPost. Thanks for being here.
Thank you so much for having me.
It's great to have you with us this hour on The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick. Debt collection is an $11 billion industry in this country. One out of every three Americans with credit files, about 70 million people in all, has been contacted by a debt collection agency in the past year. That's according to the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. And a new report suggests that some of those debt collectors have adopted aggressive tactics with the help of courts and prosecutors. The ACLU has found that courts and district attorney's offices nationwide are cooperating in issuing arrest warrants against debtors, often with the threat of jail time. Jennifer Turner is the principal human rights researcher at the ACLU and author of the new report. She says that in over 90% of cases, debt collectors are winning judgments because people who owe might not even be aware of the debt in the first place and don't show up in court.
What typically happens is that the debt collection company will file a lawsuit, which they can do in a matter of seconds because they just use boilerplate language. And often these debt collectors are what we call debt buyers. So these are companies that buy debts for pennies on the dollar and then sue to collect. And then later, once they have the judgment, they will often fail to adequately inform somebody about the hearing. And when that person misses the hearing, that's when the debt collector asks for a warrant. And what we're finding is that courts are all too happy to comply with whatever the debt collector is asking for. And that's part of the problem. The courts are entirely complicit in a system that's systematically basically extracting money from people.
When I was reading your report, I wondered, why isn't this between the creditor and the debtor? Why is some third party coming in and asking for warrants?
Well, creditors often write off the debt as a bad debt. They'll decide, well, it's not worth pursuing, and they'll sell it to companies that will take on that debt, some of which are very aggressive in trying to seek out warrants to get people jailed. In Georgia, I talked to a woman who had been evicted from her trailer home. Her landlord threw out all her belongings. She ended up homeless, and then she was low income and didn't have a stable address for years, had no idea her landlord had sued her and gotten a judgment for money he claimed she owed for the cost of throwing out her belongings. And ultimately, a company that's local there that's very commonly buys up these old eviction judgments went after her. And she had no idea that she'd been sued, much less that a warrant had been issued for her arrest, and was at her mom's deathbed, literally, when cops showed up and jailed her overnight. Although it's officially warrants for failure to appear in court or failure to answer written questions about your finances, in effect, what's happening to people is they're being jailed because they can't pay. And judges are requiring people to pay bail in order to be released from jail. And they're often setting bail at the exact amount owed. And whatever bail money people do pay generally gets paid over to the debt collector. So this is about extracting money from people. So it's not really about contempt of court.
Right. So technically, this is failure to appear, right? Mm-hmm. From the court's perspective, this isn't a debtor's prison. Talk a little bit more about how this works from the perspective of the courts, because what you're describing is not only an extraction policy, but also basically a warrant mill.
It is a warrant mill. Courts have become collector's courts. And judges are seeing the same debt collectors in court every day, filing numerous lawsuits, and they've become very comfortable with this role of effectively being a mill to process these debt collection suits. And the entire system is predicated on the idea that people will not come to court to defend themselves. And the horrible reality is that for many of these cases, debt collectors don't have the kind of evidence that would be required to win at trial. So if people did defend themselves, if they did ask the magic words, "Do you have evidence to show that I really owe this debt?" or that the statute of limitations hasn't expired, which is often the case. "Do you have evidence to show that I owe this amount and that I didn't make payments already?" They would win those cases, but the courts simply do not have the capacity to deal with millions of debt collection lawsuits if people really showed up.
You also looked at bounced checks. Talk about that.
Yes. Prosecutors are getting in the game of debt collection and contracting with private check collection companies in the case of bounced checks. So when people bounce checks, in theory, prosecutors can prosecute those cases when a crime has occurred. But prosecutors, through these contracts, are forwarding reports of any bounced check to private companies that are then empowered to send threatening letters to people, to consumers, on the letterhead of the prosecutor's office, telling them that they've been accused of committing a crime, face criminal prosecution and up to a year in jail if they don't pay up, not just the amount of the bounced check, but also potentially hundreds of dollars in fees. And over 200 prosecutors' offices have contracts with these private companies. And people are required to pay not only a range of fees, but also to take a financial accountability course, for which they must also pay over $200, that's run by the same company.
Is this allowed? A private debt company using the letterhead and the imprimatur of a local DA? I mean, I get that letter and I think I'm hearing from the local prosecutor.
You would think it's not allowed. In fact, it was not allowed under the federal consumer protection laws, the FDCPA. And in fact, after numerous class action lawsuits were filed against these companies lobbied Congress for a loophole to be added to the federal consumer law that would allow them to do this. And they've been sued numerous times. These companies settle these lawsuits. They reincorporate under new names. Finally, one of these large companies was sued by the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. And under the settlement agreement, they have to, on their letter, say that they are sending the letter on behalf of the prosecutor's office, whereas other companies continue to send letters that look, for all intents and purposes, like they're from the prosecutor.
So, Jennifer, creditors have a right to get paid. Private debt collection isn't going anywhere as an agency. People should pay their debts, of course. So what does reform look like here?
Well, reform here is about building in protections for consumers. Really, there's no place for warrants and jailing in civil debt collection cases. But at a minimum, legislators can pass laws that require that debt collectors provide real notice to people so that they know about the hearing that they need to attend. We also can require that judges can't impose bail or turn over bail money to creditors. We can require that people never be taken into custody. If somebody has a warrant issued against them, we'd simply require them to file information about their finances and don't take them into jail. In the case of district attorney's offices, contracts with check collection companies, we can terminate the contracts. That's a pretty simple solution as well.
Jennifer Turner, principal human rights researcher with the ACLU. Jennifer, thanks for being here.
Thanks so much for having me.
We reached out to the Association of Credit and Collections Professionals, as well as several of the debt collection agencies cited in the ACLU report. The ACA gave us this response in part: to claim that debt collectors are manipulating our judiciary system for their exclusive benefit is simply wrong and runs counter to judicial independence. ACA members follow federal and state law and do not advocate for, nor can they cause, a consumer to be arrested or jailed for an outstanding debt. Like any other civil court case, only a judge at his or her sole discretion can issue an arrest warrant that calls for jail time, and only when an individual has been ruled to be in contempt of court for failing to respond to a court order. You can read that full statement on our website at thetakeaway.org. Thanks for being with us on this Friday Takeaway. It's great to have you. I'm Todd Zwillick. Black Panther hit theaters last Friday and since then has morphed into a full-blown vibranium-powered cultural sensation.
Hey, look at your suit. You've been taking bullets, charging it up with kinetic energy.
Put around the truck. Ready, go!
Black Panther has blown past expectations. It broke box office records, earning over $420 million in 4 days, the fifth highest opening weekend gross in film history, and in the company of box office smashes like Star Wars and Avengers. Now, unlike past Marvel releases, though, Black Panther features an African-American lead and a predominantly black cast, and of course, African-American director Ryan Coogler. Businesses, church groups, even celebrities are joining in on the film's outpouring of black positivity, and they've rushed to buy tickets.
I knew it was an opportunity to pull from real things, real achievements, real African culture, and place it in this movie to make it real. That's what the opportunity is in this movie. So if anybody believes, you know, that Africa didn't have empire, didn't have architecture, didn't have art, didn't have science, you see it in this movie.
That's Chadwick Boseman, the star of Black Panther. It's the biggest movie from a black director and a black lead actor ever on the American scene. Here to talk about the cultural phenomenon is Dr. Jonathan Gray, professor of English at John Jay College and the CUNY Graduate Center in New York. And he's working on his second book, Illustrating the Race. It examines a representation of African-Americans in comics from 1966 to the age of President Barack Obama. Dr. Jonathan Gray, thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me.
We're going to talk about the phenomenon of Black Panther in American culture at the box office and everywhere else. But first of all, can I get a chance just to talk about this movie with you a little bit before we get going, kind of whet the appetite?
Yeah, it'd be a pleasure.
For all the reasons that Black Panther has been successful, this is, to me, an extraordinary superhero film.
Yeah, I mean, I think T'Challa is a child of lineage and a child of privilege. We sort of get the best of both worlds when it comes to that. He's sure of his place in the world, in part because Wakanda has never been colonized, in part because it is this flourishing ethical society. So he is not full of self-doubt, which would seem to maybe make him a flat character, but actually it provides sort of a rich moral core that makes him appealing.
That's the world of Wakanda in the Marvel Universe.
Yes.
Let's talk about the real world and the role of this movie that it's had in the couple of weeks since it's come out. The hashtag Black Panther Challenge has raised thousands of dollars. I don't even know, hundreds of thousands of dollars at this point to send kids to see this movie. Mm-hmm. What's going on here?
Well, I mean, I think at a basic level, everyone understands that representation matters, right? That's part of the reason why on the right wing, you have people complaining whenever like something is changed. It's like, oh, well, you know, you're a social justice warrior. It's like, no, what you're actually saying is that representation matters. And so that's sort of a negative spin on it. But the Black Panther Challenge is a positive spin on that, right? Representation matters. Therefore, let's get as many kids to see this movie as possible. I think for an entire generation, this is going to be their Star Wars. Right. I mean, there are dozens of people, hundreds of people working in Hollywood today who saw Star Wars and said, oh, my God, this is possible. Right. And so I think that that's part of the hope that, you know, a generation can see this film and, you know, hey, another world is possible. And you can't change the world without being able to imagine a different world Wakanda is a tremendous act of the imagination. It's an act of collective imagination, you know, building on Jack Kirby, Stan Lee, Christopher Priest, Reginald Hudlin, Ta-Nehisi Coates. All of these creators put their vision into the film, and Ryan Coogler does a great job of sort of building out that world. And it's like, well, hey, like, let's get as many people to see this possible world as possible. And I think it's great.
Films have been chipping away at the idea that black films, especially black films that have their diversity out in front, can't be financially successful.
Right.
Black Panther has shattered that. Certainly Get Out shattered that.
Right.
No question. Other black films have been successful, but this is a different level. What's going on in American entertainment in Hollywood right now, do you think?
So I think one of the things, obviously, is that this is the 18th film in the Marvel Cinematic Universe, right? And so Marvel has it down to a science in terms of how to roll their films out across the world. But to your larger point, I think it's important that in the last, you know, year and a half, four of the biggest movies, Girls Trip, the comedy, Get Out, also Black Panther, and looking forward a little bit, Ava DuVernay's Wrinkle in Time, that these movies all feature, you know, talented black directors. Where I think before, you had black talent in front of the camera. So you had a Denzel, you had a Will Smith. Now, the people who are sort of getting the credit are the creators themselves. And so I think that that's the important shift here. It's like, oh, well, let's give this money to Ava DuVernay and let her build her world. Let's give this money to Jordan Peele and let him build his world. And that's, I think, really significant.
You might argue that Black Panther wouldn't have been such a gigantic hit if it had come out 3 years ago, that this moment, mm-hmm. this political moment in America mm-hmm. is part of what drives up the cultural demand for this kind of art. Talk about that.
I mean, yeah, comics and film always reflect on the current political situation. The first issue of Captain America has Cap punching Hitler in the face, right? So punching Nazis has always been a thing in comics, despite what some people might tell you. So, I mean, Captain America's not a hit if he doesn't debut with this sort of shocking image on the cover. Wonder Woman wouldn't have been a hit if it wasn't for a certain pent-up demand as well. I mean, I think these are successful movies no matter when they're released. But I think that, sure, they are responding to the cultural zeitgeist and the time. And I also think that this is nothing new. I think that in some ways, Star Wars, for example, coming out in the wake of Watergate, you know, was part of the reason people wanted to escape into a different world because they were sort of disillusioned with this one. And I think that that, you know, ties in here as well. There's almost too much news. I don't know how you do your job these days, right? And so it's like, hey, let's get away from that. Let's get to a world where people are moral and ethical, where women are treated with respect, right? Where women in STEM are celebrated and not, you know, the subject of some rant at Google. Right. I mean, so I think that there are a lot of threads that come together to give this movie the momentum that it currently enjoys.
Jonathan Gray, I want to thank you not only for coming in to talk to me, but also for writing about this film as well. It's made an enormous difference.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Dr. Jonathan Gray, professor of English at John Jay College in New York. The Olympics will wrap up this weekend with Ivanka Trump headed to Pyeongchang for a meeting with the South Korean president and to attend the closing ceremonies there. The opening of the game saw dueling dignitary photo ops, Mike Pence and the sister of Kim Jong-un, and speculation about the power balance between the United States and North and South Korea. Jillian Weinberger is on the ground talking to South Koreans about how they're now viewing their estranged neighbors to the North.
I'm Jillian Weinberger, and I'm here in Pyeongchang for Vox Media and NBC Sports. I think a lot of Americans don't necessarily understand what it's like to live close to North Korea. I think we tend to be fairly anxious about North Korea, especially these days. But when I've talked to South Koreans about what it's like to live here, and especially to South Koreans about what it's like to live close to the DMZ and closer to the North Korean border, they really emphasize that they want Americans and they want the rest of the world to know that they don't feel fear. And I spoke with one South Korean in particular. His name is No Yun So. He is the curator of the DMZ Museum, which is a museum in Gangwon province, not too far from where the Olympics are being held. And he has lived there his whole life and served in the army there. So I talked to him about what it's like to live near the DMZ.
A lot of foreigners, they ask them, and then they expect, why it seems like they're very dangerous. But it's like, you know, after the Korean War, we lived like this with the tension between two Koreans for a long time. This situation is like, you know, lifestyle. So we don't feel any danger.
I also had the opportunity to go to a hockey game, and it was a special hockey game. It was the combined Korean women's team. It was the second game they played together, and it was against Sweden. It was a really interesting experience. The combined team lost 8-0. But most of the people I met there really weren't worried about the score. They were there for this historic moment. It was a lot of families. And I spoke with one man. His name is Kim Won-jae. He's 65 years old. And he was also there with his whole family, including his grandson, who was just a toddler. And I asked him what he hopes for his grandson's future and for his country's future.
Unification is kind of hard right now. But when he grows up, it will get better, like West Germany and East Germany. He helped him.
And also at the hockey game, I met one young woman who is 16 years old. Her name is Yoon Lee, and she was one of the few South Koreans I've met who was really, really hopeful about reunification and really excited to be there to see the combined team play together.
Of course, it will take lots of time and lots of effort and lots of money for reunification, but I hope 20 years or 30 years later, it will one day happen. That's my kind of bucket list.
I also got to see the North Korean cheerleaders at the game. They were chanting this now pretty famous cheer, cheer up, cheer up, and the whole crowd, the whole arena cheered along. And, you know, the whole crowd was really into the game. But it seems to me, just from, you know, talking to a lot of young South Koreans, that they either don't think about reunification all that much or they're just not that interested in it. It was interesting. One of my colleagues here was speaking to a group of young South Koreans while he was waiting for the shuttle. And the shuttle stopped and the whole group of North Korean cheerleaders came off the bus. He said it was amazing to watch these, you know, young South Koreans looking at these young North Koreans, the cheerleaders, and the South Koreans said that they had never seen a North Korean before. And this one young man was really surprised. His name is Kyung Do Kim, and this is what he said right after he laid eyes on North Koreans for the first time.
They look similar with us, but I think they live in another generation.
In Pyeongchang, I'm Jillian Weinberger for The Podium from NBC Sports and Vox Media.
You can find a link to The Podium podcast on our website at thetakeaway.org, and you'll find a great story there about the fight to get women ski jumping into the Olympics. Check it out. The 21st New York International Children's Film Festival starts today, but the fans lining up are not just kids.
I'm in my 30s. I don't have any kids. I look forward to this festival every year.
Rebecca Pauly is associate editor at Film Journal International. She's seen a lot of the films the festival has brought together this year. And she says there's a lot to learn from kids' films these days, no matter what your age.
Well, the Children's Film Festival, as you know, is international. So you see a mix of a lot of different cultures. There's the film Liana, which is a documentary live-action hybrid about five orphans from Swaziland. There are films from China, Japan, France. And it really just is important in how it shows and exposes kids to a lot of different cultures. And it really teaches kids, or adults as the case may be, empathy, looking past initial differences and really becoming friends with people and, you know, showing empathy for people and understanding. And doing that in a way that's fun, that isn't didactic or preachy.
Now, you were especially taken with animated films. And I know that in the children's film genre, animation is just a huge part of presentation.
Oh, absolutely. And there's a lot of animation. Obviously, Japan with Studio Ghibli and anime. France has a huge, thriving animation community. And these are films that you don't really get a chance to see that often in theaters.
We're not talking Disney here.
No, this is you tend to see, if you're taking your kids to a film in the United States, you're seeing Disney, you're seeing Pixar, you're seeing DreamWorks. But there's so much more out there if you're willing to experiment and think outside of the box a little bit.
What does children's film now have to offer in the presentation of women and heroines and female characters and heroes?
It's definitely gotten a lot better just in the wider sense and with this film festival in particular. I mean, you look at the older films going back to Cinderella and Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs, and the heroines tend to be a little bit passive, someday my prince will come, that sort of thing. Now you are seeing heroines who stand up for themselves more often, who are not dependent on a sort of romance plot line. And in the short programs, which is one of the most popular components of the festival, there's this girls' POV shorts program that has three shorts, all of them directed by women. One of them about a female basketball player, one of them about a female DJ, and then one of them about a woman who survived China's Cultural Revolution as a child. It's really giving great examples for girls about, you know, you can be anything. You don't just have to be a princess. You don't just have to be somebody's, you know, cool sidekick, you know, the sidekick to a man's story. I think you're really seeing great examples of heroines that young girls seeing these films can live up to.
Are audiences demanding something different here? Are parents demanding something different from these films that these representations are really changing in a noticeable way?
I definitely think that, yes, parents do want to see more positive representation on film for these young girls. And not for nothing, I think that's also important for boys to see. And there is actually a boy short program at this year's festival, too, that sort of acts as a counterpart to the girls' POV section. Just to kind of get you out of these strict modes of this is the sort of thing that boys do and this is the sort of thing that girls do. Never the twain shall meet.
That's a form of empathy itself, isn't it?
Absolutely. I think that's incredibly important, and that's one of the most important things that film can do in general, especially with kids when, you know, you're in that formative stage. These are lessons that you need to know.
Rebecca Pauly, Associate Editor at Film Journal International. What a pleasure. Thanks for being here.
Thanks so much for having me.
In Syria, over 400 civilians have been killed in eastern Ghouta since Sunday, a rebel-held area outside of Damascus. The forces of President Bashar al-Assad have been bombing the territory, backed by Russian aircraft. This is one of just a few rebel strongholds left in Syria. 7 years of war and destruction in that country. More than 5.4 million Syrians have fled the country since the civil war began, according to the United Nations. In some cases, pulled by the hope of safety elsewhere, in most cases pushed out of their homes by bombs or bullets or secret police.
No one leaves easily. They leave perhaps their communities, their properties, their families, their friends, their homeland, everything they've ever known, to throw themselves into a future that's profoundly, profoundly uncertain.
That's Wendy Perlman, a professor at Northwestern University. Between 2012 and 2016, Wendy Perlman spoke with over 300 Syrian refugees. She used their stories to piece together a picture of Syria. It became the book, We Crossed a Bridge and It Trembled, Voices from Syria. It was published last year. I spoke with Wendy Perlman about what life is like for millions of Syrian refugees as the violence continues inside their country.
What people are suffering is beyond words. The bloodshed, the death, and this comes after years of siege and starvation, a population that's already been strangled, that has endured more than any human being should have to endure. Now, in addition, enduring horrific airstrikes that are bombing families, that are bombing hospitals. It's a siege whose horror and terror is just horrific, and it's happening before the eyes of the world, and it's happened before.
Now, in your interviews in your book, Wendy, you met a character, a man, Anas, is a doctor who comes from eastern Ghouta. Where did you meet him, and what did he tell you his life was like in that town east of Damascus?
Yeah, so I met Enes in Turkey, where he's now working as a doctor again. He's from Eastern Ghouta, and he talked to me about his life before 2011, the kind of fear and silence that many Syrians experienced under a brutal authoritarian regime that used surveillance, undercover informants, corruption, co-optation to maintain a system that was fundamentally unfree. He also talked to me about how he went out in protests in early 2011, like hundreds of thousands of other Syrians, millions, calling for freedom, for dignity, for political change. And he told me about a particular protest in April 2011 in which huge, huge crowds came out in Eastern Ghouta and throughout the Damascus suburbs. And he said to me that this huge crowd of people calling for freedom were going from town to town and at one point crossed a bridge. And he said, "We crossed a bridge and it trembled under the weight of so many people, that show of people's power." For me, it was such a powerful image that I made it the title of the book.
Yes.
It reminds us of the power of people's power that happened in Eastern Ghouta, the same places that's on our TV screens today, also happened throughout Syria. And it's important to remember because as we see the siege now and the horror and the war and the killing and the bodies and the sheer terror, it's important to remember that this conflict began a popular uprising calling for freedom. It began with popular protests. That memory should not be buried along with the dead.
You spoke with hundreds of refugees for your book. Why are most people picking up and fleeing their country to Europe and elsewhere?
Many, many people flee, leaving for their very lives. I talked to people who fled in the middle of the night, who fled with nothing but the clothes on their back, who fled even without their very papers to identify who they are and what they had experienced in life and their degrees and so forth, and then suffer for that later on when they have no paperwork to try to start their life anew. People flee bombs. There are people who flee because they are at risk of being arrested. And Syrians would say to me again and again, you know, you wish that you would die by a bomb or a bullet rather than be arrested and thrown in a regime prison where there's a slow death of torture, of starvation, of disease, of overcrowding. There are others who maybe are coming from areas that have not come under bombardment, who maybe are not at risk of arrest, but see no future in the country, in a place where the economy's collapsed, where inflation is skyrocketing, where no one knows what will happen. There are others who come from safer circumstances, but also decide to leave the country.
Well, your book has so many personal stories of people who fled. Tell the story of Bushra, one of many characters who wound up living in tents, of course, in refugee camps.
Yeah. So Bushra is someone I met actually in Lebanon, where the situation of refugees is really terrible. There are no official UN refugee camps in Lebanon. Instead, hundreds of thousands of Syrians are living in informal tent settlements. They basically have a tent, you know, in any empty field, maybe rent it from a landlord by the meter. So there are small settlements of a dozen or a few dozen tents scattered throughout the country. And that's more difficult because in a formal refugee camp, as horrific as that is too, there's often space to have a clinic or a school. So these informal tent settlements throughout Lebanon have a different type of challenges. So Bushra was talking about how her young daughter, her tent was the only kind of home she'd ever known that she could remember. So Bushra talked about how once she went to a women's center where she was doing some activities, and it was a real building with real walls. And her daughter was so excited to be in a place where there was real walls that she said, Mom, take a picture of me next to the wall," as if it were something remarkable to document.
Wendy, what about the future for so many people who fled? What do people feel like the future of Syria is, and do they see themselves as having any role in it? Not only returning, maybe returning to the country, but being able to get a life back in Syria.
It's hugely uncertain. And even in the course of doing my interviews, I've seen this change over time. When I first began interviewing Syrians in 2012, those who'd fled the country, everybody had their bags packed. Everyone said, you know, we're going to go home any moment now. I would talk to people who said, you know, I'm not going to buy a can opener or dishes because I have that back home and I'm going back home. People expected to return to Syria really at any moment. The next summer, when I continued with interviews in 2013, I could see that hope or that confidence of returning beginning to fade and people beginning to think, wow, maybe this exile will be more permanent. People that I met in in Jordan, Lebanon, and Turkey were beginning to think, you know, there are rumors of people getting to Europe. That was 2013. By 2015, many of the same people I'd interviewed were already in Europe. They were learning Swedish or learning German, getting their paperwork done, trying to think about how to restart life from zero. So while many people continue to hold in their heart the hope that they will return to their homeland, to the land that they love, and recreate the communities that are now shattered and scattered, given the sheer passage of time, many people have no choice but to look forward and provide for themselves and their families. That's the reality after 7 years of war and millions of people displaced.
Wendy Perlman, professor and author of We Crossed a Bridge and It Trembled, Voices from Syria. Wendy Perlman, thank you so much.
Thank you.
We opened the show today talking about how teachers are reacting to school shootings. And now, a student's perspective.
Hi, my name is Kyra Simon. I'm a 17-year-old junior at Marjory Stoneman Douglas. What I scoffed at and believed to be another fire drill was a horrific shooting that would take away 17 souls and wreak havoc on a community unaccustomed to acts of violence. When we were instructed to evacuate the premises and I heard whispers of a shooting occurring in my school, I was in disbelief. News that my friend Helena Ramsey was killed in the shooting set me into utter shock. Seeing students speak out and conducting my own research on gun control and the grasp the NRA holds on the government has motivated me to do all that I can to create a change. The solution is not arming teachers or turning schools into penitentiaries with armed guards, but putting measures in place that will restrict access to assault rifles. My life will never be the same, and I will never be okay, and so I know this will never happen again.
Thanks so much for being with us today. Have a good weekend, everybody. I'm Todd Zwillick. This is The Takeaway.